Hello, everyone. I am Diana Isaacs. I'm an endocrine clinical pharmacist at the Cleveland Clinic, and I am with
Natalie Bellini, and I am an endocrine nurse practitioner in upstate New York.
And we are so excited to welcome you to this very special edition of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives, where we are live at the Association of Diabetes Care and Education Specialists annual meeting in Baltimore. And we have interviewed a number of amazing guests over this four-day conference, and we are so excited to share it all with you. We are so excited to be here today with Anastasia Albanese O'Neill, who is the ADCES Diabetes Care and Education Specialist of the Year.
Yay!
So welcome, Anastasia. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your role in diabetes?
Oh my goodness. Well, thank you for having me, first of all. So I've had a lot of different roles in I guess, the diabetes space. It's the second career for me. So in my first career, I worked in marketing for Southwest Airlines, and actually have a couple degrees in political science. So nothing to do with any of this. I became a diabetes educator after our daughter was diagnosed with type 1. She was 16 months. I went back to school and became a nurse in 2008, and initially worked in a basic science project called MPOD. Which was looking at why type 1 diabetes happens. So really trying to understand type 1 diabetes in humans. I went back to school, became a nurse practitioner, and got a PhD, and that's when I started doing research in diabetes technology, quality improvement, and diabetes education. I spent a lot of years in clinic, and then most recently changed to a job at JDRF. So I've worked in kind of a variety of capacities in the diabetes space.
Wow, amazing.
Wow. So tell me about your time at ADCES this year. Talk to us a little bit about presentations and what you've done this weekend.
Yeah, so ADCES has been amazing as always. Everyone I have talked to is just talking about how inspired they are and how excited they are to be back in person. So I guess, first of all, I've attended some really amazing talks that have made me think again about how we approach diabetes and diabetes care and diabetes education. So I just want to give a nod to the organizers. I only had one talk this year, and in my new role at JDRF, we're really focused on a couple of things, but importantly, type 1 diabetes risk screening. And that talk was really around the guidelines for pre-symptomatic type 1 diabetes, the fact that type 1 diabetes is staged, and that we can now, doing a simple blood test to look for autoantibodies, determine who is at risk for type 1 diabetes, and in some measure, the rate of progression to a diagnosis. And the reason that's important is because in the United States, 40 to 60% of children and adolescents are diagnosed in DKA. And DKA, yeah, it's high. And DKA carries with it at diagnosis higher A1C over time, between 0.8 and over 1%, depending on whether you are in a moderate or severe DKA, and also cognitive. It changes in cognitive function, so IQ, memory, and also sort of brain infrastructure. So we really need our brain development. We don't have a lot of data on adults, but we do have data on children and adolescents, and so we need to. If you look at research studies, and tell me if I'm going on too long, but if you look at research, what we know from the DAISY study, from the TEDDY study, from the ASS study, from the FRIDA study, we know that rates of DKA can go from where they are now all the way down to as low as 3%. And the average is around 5%. In TEDDY, it was 6%. So we can take DKA from 1 in 2 to 1 in 20. By screening and monitoring. The question is, how do we scale that outside of the research setting? And so the other thing I will note on that is we need to know if people are at risk so we can engage them in research to prevent or delay type 1 diabetes. And if we don't know you're at risk, you can't participate in the study. So we've got two benefits, a clinical benefit and then also a benefit really to the future of prevention. And so I think that it's important, and I am always surprised when people aren't familiar with the staging, when they're not familiar with the DKA rates in the United States, and also, again, the associated comorbidities, and then the potential we have to change those things. So that was really fun to talk about, and I think there's a lot of opportunities for people to get engaged.
Awesome. Wow. So with that, I'm kind of curious, can you tell us a little bit about some of the things you're working on at JDRF?
Yeah, so certainly screening. I think JDRF is committed to population level screening. So that means we would, I think you both know that 85% of the time, people with type 1 diabetes have no family history. So while having someone in your family with type 1 diabetes puts you at higher risk, in fact, 15 times higher risk, most of the time the diagnosis is made in primary care. So primary care folks need to be our partners as well. So we have a long-term goal of population screening. Our short-term goal is to get every family member of a person with type 1 diabetes to really think about how they can engage in that process. TrialNet screened about 200,000. The ASK study has screened about 30,000 more. We would estimate if there are 1.8 million Americans living with type 1 that there's probably about 5 to 6 million first-degree relatives out there. Where are they and why haven't they engaged on screening? And we want people to know how to do it, where to do it, who's eligible, and then the most important part is monitoring so we prevent DKA at diagnosis. So I'm working on that. And then the other key piece is clinical trial. How can I say this? We want to create a culture of clinical trial engagement in the type 1 diabetes community, and we want more diversity in those studies. We want people who've been left out generation after generation to participate and to feel confident when they do. And so we're really focusing on how do we create that culture in the type 1 diabetes community so we can see if things work, we can see if things don't work, and we can move the science forward faster.
What do you think about some of the drugs in the pipeline for, I guess, prevention or delay of type 1 diabetes?
Yeah, so I think everyone knows now that teplizumab is in front of the FDA, and that showed that, you know, it delayed the onset of type 1 diabetes an average of 3 years. Antithymocyte globulin is another agent that has been looked at diagnosis in the United States, and we saw that preserved C-peptide and lower A1C. The Inodia group in Europe is looking at that. Verapamil is a fairly common drug that's being looked at to sort of prevent beta cell inflammation. And the thing that's really cool about the research is it's global. And I think you're going to see that aspect of it, that we can learn from what's happening in Australia or in Israel or in the United Kingdom or in Europe or here, Canada or elsewhere, and share that knowledge and move forward more quickly.
Wow. Can you talk to us a little bit? Let's change gears back to the ADCES award.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that all our viewers or listeners know that you kind of get to pick a project and a focus for the year. Can you talk a little bit about what your thoughts are around what you might do with this honor? I mean, it truly is an honor.
Yeah, no, I'm very humbled by the award. I mean, there's a lot of extraordinary people out there. I've been spending time with them since I got here on Thursday. So I think about this a lot because the other hat I wore for many years was as director of clinical operations and pediatrics at the University of Florida, and I also directed our diabetes education program. And as we see new technologies come online, as we see new drugs come online or treatments, right? We saw different glucagons come online, and so the nasal glucagon and the liquid stable glucagon. As we see a number of options, connected pens, whatever it may be. The question is, are they equitably offered to everyone? First of all, are they offered to everyone? And I think the answer probably is no. The second is, does the clinic have the capacity to support that person in succeeding with that device? Can they provide the right education, the right training? The answer, I'll be honest, is probably no. And then the question is, are our partners in this process, in primary care, in federally qualified health centers, also primary care, but sort of a different spin, and elsewhere, inpatient, can these devices and treatments be supported in all of those settings so the person has continuity in their diabetes management? I'm really interested in process, and I think process is part of answering the equity question. So certainly we got to talk about payment, and we've got to talk about access, but we also have to talk about process, because if your clinic can't support technology, then a disparity is created for the people that you see. And so I'd really like to explore opportunities to make sure that educators and their clinical partners have the tools they need to make sure that technology is accessible to everybody and they know how to use it in the optimal way.
I love that topic. I think that's such a great platform. And I know we had actually worked on a paper in the past about technology integration, the role of the diabetes care and education specialist, and the potential for the DCES to be that technology champion. So along those lines, curious if you could share any of your best practices when you're at the University of Florida about workflow in terms of, especially with CGM or other technology, like getting that to people equitably.
Yeah, so we went from 7% CGM use to about 80 sustained use in our clinic. And part of it is because we're in PEDS, so I know that, and we did have Medicaid coverage, but we fought for that. So we actually spoke with AHCA and Medicaid at the state level to cover training, because what inspired this is people were showing up. This was back in the days of the G4 and the G5, but actually the G4, and we would actually get the device prescribed and get it covered, and then they would ship it to the person's home because the training wasn't covered. And people would show up to clinic with a box, sometimes of expired supplies, and say, I have no idea what to do with this thing. And so it was at that time that we created the process and said, not only do we need to pay for the device, but we need to pay for the training. That code also needs to be covered, and the interpretation of the data, so that we can have that conversation about time and range and how to use the data you're seeing in the AGP, right? The report that people get on their phone to make their own decisions and inform their behavior. So I think the first thing is process in clinics. So we were lucky, we had an Epic Builder, but we had to partner on how we were going to build out the inputs to the template, and then we worked with the coders to build a very specific way to write the notes so that it would get approved for payment, and then also training everybody to use it. And then if folks in the practice didn't see value in the device, we actually had people come in and everybody put one on their body, and they could see in their own lives what it was like to use a CGM and see that if they ate low carb, they'd have a low, if they didn't have type 1 or type 2 diabetes, they'd have a low standard deviation when they ate low carb, and if they ate a lot of carbs, they could see a wider standard deviation. So we put a lot of processes in place. I think these should be shared. The person at the end of the day is the person with diabetes, and so I don't think every clinic should have to reinvent the wheel, and I think ADC CES has a profound role in making sure that these, whether they're chart templates, whether they're patient instructions, whether they're a process you use to train, like the data method that you developed, Diana, but whatever those are, that they're available widely, easy to get, they're not firewalled, and that they can be shared. So we need instructions in Cerner, we need them in Allscripts, whatever all of those are, and they should be shared widely. And we need to convince our partners in EHR to put them in the library.
It sounds like you have 5 years of work to do. I mean, maybe six, right?
Six.
It is such a need, and I agree with you. It is, if we can't get, so lots of times in an endocrine practice, you have an educator, you have a dietitian, you have a psychologist, you have some support,
yeah.
And everyone is there because they want to be. So when you go into a primary care practice where it is much more diverse and there's lots of other medical problems, I think that that's where we really need to start focusing.
Mm-hmm.
Although we all know that every endocrine practice doesn't do it well either. I want your notes. I want you to write those standard blocks so that we can all share them.
Yes.
So that everyone has similar
yes.
style, and that when your patient transfers to my practice, I can see that, right?
Right.
If we're communicating on the same level.
Yes.
I would love that. I really would. What a phenomenal idea.
Yeah, well, and the elements need to be the same. And I think, what are the discrete variables here? So you mentioned, I hope it's okay to say, you talked to Dave Walton from T1D Exchange, right? So, you know, those clinics are really working at sort of harmonizing the discrete variables that right. you extract from the chart and can compare. So we actually have some understanding of where we are and where we need to go, right? But if you can't collect those in a discrete way in the clinic and you can't get them back out of the EHR, what good is it, right? If I can't share it with you and you can't find it. So we shouldn't be doing manual chart review.
Right.
We need to build the system so that we can actually leverage the information to improve outcomes. And I couldn't agree with you more. I think too, in the primary care setting, we're not gonna have the same model we have in specialty care. So what's the minimum staffing model look like? What does, I was speaking with a group of nurse practitioners at a conference, and they had a lot of questions about, how do I get the data out of the device? What platform is free? What's this thing called Tidepool? You know, should I use what's associated with the device? What if we don't have Wi-Fi in the clinic and the person doesn't have a data plan? You know, so all of these really real world questions, what's actionable? I think it's okay to say, because they said it in the annual meeting, but ADCES worked really hard on some competencies that actually give some clarity to practices of all levels about what are the minimum things a person in that practice should know. So if you have a front desk person, and they're the person who calls and reminds people about their appointment, they should tell them to bring the reader and the transmitter and the sensor, if it has all three parts, so that you can do everything you need to do in that visit. Because when they want show up without one component, it doesn't work. But that should be standard practice. So I think ADCES can leverage those competencies over the next year and five. So to actually build in processes that can be reproduced across the United States and hopefully elsewhere.
And ultimately improve outcomes for patients with diabetes.
Well, that's the end goal, right? Right. So, right. So the bottom line is not like who did it or who thought of it first or who does it better, but really at the end of the day, did the person living with diabetes get the device they needed, get the training they needed and the education they needed, and then actually have the partnership and care they need to live well? I couldn't agree more. I feel like I'm talking a lot and I should be listening more.
No, so this is exactly what we want.
This is so amazing, and I so appreciate that you've always been willing to share all your tools that you've developed to help people with their workflow and all just helping people to, you know, help their patients.
Yeah, I think, you know, something I will share, and I don't talk about it often, but I decided I'm going to talk about it more, and we're probably wrapping up, but when I was at the University of Florida, I had on my own time, developed a website called T1D Toolkit, because I really felt like that we needed a video and online component to the print materials we gave out in clinic. And when I left the University of Florida, there was this whole debate with the Office of Technological Licensing and all the lawyers about, do we keep it or do we give it to her, or what do we split it, or what are we going to do? And then finally they said, you know what, when she leaves, no one's going to do it. No one's going to keep it up. So they spun it off to me with the agreement that in perpetuity the university could use it as I updated it. No problem. But what has happened over time is other people are using the site. And it's, again, which is my mantra, free in the public domain, available, reviewed by medical experts. So that's out there, because it's things as simple as, I think when people use insulin pumps, I worked in pediatrics, so the parent may remember when they were trained to use a syringe. But that child who is now 14 or 15 maybe has never tried it. And when they have a pump failure, they don't know how to draw insulin out of a vial. So there's really simple videos on there that they can follow that have been reviewed medically and they can use in real time. And so I just want people to know that that resource is another thing that's out there. But I will share and share widely, because I think at the end of the day is what you said, Diana, is the person with diabetes, and you too, Natalie, it's the person with diabetes. And I think we shouldn't be reinventing the wheel.
How do we access that site?
It is at t1dtoolkit.org.
Thank you.
Yes. Free. So if you're in primary care, primary care, if you need somebody to watch a video on using an insulin pen, it's there.
Wow.
So, and another partner organization actually co-branded the videos, the American Diabetes Association, because I think in diabetes, we need to pull on the same side of the rope, because so they actually put it through their medical review. So if anybody's worried about, is this a good video on using an insulin pen, their logo is on it. So imperfect, better to have somebody review, but that's another thing, and I don't know, maybe this will be part of the platform, but I feel like in diabetes care and education, and you all know, we see the same people often, and I would love to see all of the big diabetes organizations, and we already do this, but really pull together, and so we can push forward faster, and however we can partner. I'm at JDRF now, but whoever's out there, I think these partnerships are essential to move things more quickly.
So. I totally agree. Awesome. Versus us all doing different things, and
right.
Yes.
Together, right. Yeah.
Well, if ADCES is doing it, JDRF can point to them. If ADA is doing it, we can all point to them, right? T1D Exchange is doing it, we point to them. I mean, I think that gives us, as you said, it's going to take years. Let's accelerate that.
I do too. Any kind of final thoughts or like what things you're most excited about that you want to share?
You know, I heard something at the annual meeting today, and I think this is important, so I will just say it as a, and maybe because I have my daughter here with me and she's thinking about going to nursing school. She's 21, about to finish college, but thinking about kind of shifting. I think that this profession is extraordinary. If you are somebody who likes to, and we all know this, if you are somebody who likes to help, help people succeed, partner with people in that success, I think diabetes care and education, that this specialty is really the way to go. I think we need to find ways to encourage, inspire, and engage young people to be part of this profession. I think we need to help them find a pathway, an easy pathway into it, and mentor them so that they can move forward and be future leaders. And I think any way I can be involved in that process, I would be delighted, because they're sort of digital natives, and they're going to help carry this technology stuff forward in ways that we probably can't imagine yet. And so, I guess if you listen to the podcast or you listen to it regularly, think about a career in diabetes care and education. And if you're a diabetes care and education specialist, think about a leadership role in technology, because your voice matters. And if you step into that space, I think you will be excited to see what you can accomplish.
Well, thank you. That is such a great message. I want to congratulate you again on being diabetes care and education specialist.
Thank you.
It is so well deserved. I can't think of anyone more deserving than you. So congrats on that. And thank you so much for spending time with us today.
No, it's a privilege to be here with you. Thank you for having me.